Mr. Miller?
Good morning, Justices.
Judges, this is not the Illinois Appellate Court.
Thank you, Judge Posner. My name is Sid Miller, and I am here today for the appellant in this case. This is an appeal of a case regarding FERIA. And first, I would like to give you a brief overview of what the issue is as I see it, and then proceed to the appellant's argument. This case is about whether an appeal of a FERIA decision was timely filed in the district court below. The question is subject matter jurisdiction, and the section of FERIA that is at issue is 1821 D6. D6 is the section that deals with claims that have been decided before FDIC in its receivership capacity as to a failed financial institution. In this case, the institution was Chorus Bank. Chorus Bank was seized by the FDIC on September 11th, 2009, and in compliance with the requirement for claims, for submission of claims, plaintiff submitted his claim to FDIC on December 17th, 2009. Afterward, plaintiff waited 180 days and waited after that for an answer from FDIC as to whether the claim was going to be approved or denied. Plaintiff attempted to contact FDIC a number of times by telephone.
Mr. Miller, you can use the first person.
Thank you.
The government says that Chorus has no assets, and your case is moot because you can't get any money. There's not, right? Receiver has no assets. So what's the point? What's the point?
Well, the point is, Justice, first of all, that worthless documentation determination, worthless claim, worthless assets determination, was filed after the briefs were complete in the district court.
No assets. There are no assets. So how are you going to get any money out of this litigation?
Well, there are additional claims that could come and.
Well, it doesn't matter what claims there are. If there are no assets, what good does it do to have a claim?
Well, I maintain that FDIC has not provided sufficient documentation to prove that point.
You think the receiver does have assets?
There may be. There certainly hasn't been sufficient fact-finding yet presented to show what the situation is as to the assets that Chorus had and whether
it's not what it had, it's what the receiver has.
Yes, that's correct. But as of yet, we haven't seen any facts to support that. There is a case where FDIC prevailed in terms of having the case favorably decided when it claimed that there were no assets that were available to pay claims. In that case, the court allowed FDIC's argument because it was uncontested. I contested FDIC's claim of worthless assets shortly after the document was filed in June of 2011.
So what is the status of your challenge?
The status of my challenge is that I first want to determine.
No, the procedural status, right? So declaration of no assets was in May 2011.
That is correct.
So what did you do?
I filed...
You did something in June.
In June, I filed a motion for declaratory relief in the district court, challenging that determination first, and secondly, asking the district court to determine whether the case was properly in bankruptcy jurisdiction in the bankruptcy court for Northern District, or whether it should be.
Okay, so what's the status of that proceeding?
The status is that that it's on appeal here. The district court denied the motion for declaratory relief as moot when it announced its opinion about 3 months afterward. So at this point, the declaratory relief proceeding is not in the picture.
So the judge dismissed the proceeding?
He denied the motion as moot.
Okay, did you appeal that?
No, I did not
appeal. If you didn't appeal it and it's over with, then the ruling, its declaration that there are no assets stands, right?
Well,
so what can you do about that?
Well, at this point, the issue of whether the case is even in the district court as subject matter jurisdiction is before this court, and I believe with a favorable...
What do you mean before this court? Another case? You're talking about this case?
I'm talking about this case.
You're not challenging the determination that there are no assets.
That is correct.
Isn't that over and done with? How can you reopen and what could you do if, suppose we said, yes, there was inadequate notice? What would you do then?
I would re-raise the challenge if this case
what
were...
What do you mean re-raise? You bring a new lawsuit? You don't just re-raise. There'd be nothing in the district court if we affirm.
No, what I'm saying, Justice, is that...
We're not justices. This is the Federal Court of Appeals. We're judges.
All right, Judge. What I would do if this court reversed the dismissal of the district court case and it remanded back to the district court, I would re-raise the motion as to the substantive nature of the worthless assets determination before the district court, so that we could get some facts on the record in the district court as to whether that's a true situation or not. Mm-hmm. That would be one step I would take if this were reversed. The issue that we need to determine in this appeal is as to the application of subsection D6 of section 1821. That's 12 U.S.C. 1821 D6. It has two subsections, A and B. And in the district court's opinion, there was a clear indication that nationwide there is a split, and virtually a split down the middle between the circuits as to whether they view D6A as jurisdictional or not. I maintain that with the recent rulings coming down from the Supreme Court and from this court in Henderson v. Shinseki and in this court in Crawford v. FDIC, the D6A should be viewed as a claims processing rule and not as jurisdictional. D6B...
But even if it's not jurisdictional, it's a rule. So if you miss deadlines, ordinarily, you're out.
Well, it's not being interpreted that way so far. that there is a liberal interpretation that's being attached to these claims processing rule determinations.
In other words, so the 60 days doesn't matter?
60 days.
It's empty days, just empty language?
60 days does matter, but it's also subject to tolling.
And why should it be tolled here?
Because FDIC, I believe, and I think the evidence shows, that FDIC was not forthright in telling me what the situation was as to the status of the claim. That I called FDIC numerous times, and that they would not give me information, even though they knew that the claim had been denied. When I didn't receive written mailed notification of the claim until more than 60.
That's because you had instructed the recipient, the building, to forward it.
That is.
Why did you do that?
I had left instruction with the postal.
Those instructions are very unreliable, and it's careless.
And that's why I was calling Justice as a backup to that.
Why didn't you give your correct address to the FDIC?
I was afraid that if I gave them the correct address or an alternate post office box, a more recent post office box, that might get scrambled in their files down there. So better to leave the record at FDIC undisturbed and then have the post office forward in the belief that I could rely upon that than to try the alternative approach and have FDIC change the address.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Miller. Ms. Gunning?
May it please the Court, I'm Kathleen Gunning, representing the FDIC.
I have just one real quick question for you, because should we even reach the prudential mootness claim if we find that the 60-day limit is jurisdictional? Which of your lack of jurisdiction arguments should take precedence?
Well, you don't have to reach the prudential mootness, Your Honor. There's several bases to uphold the dismissal, and the most direct is the one that the district court relied on, lack of timely notice within the 60 days, because he failed to meet the deadline. You don't even have to reach the issue of jurisdiction, because even if it's not jurisdictional, under equitable tolling principles, he can't prevail. He hasn't demonstrated extraordinary circumstances.
What about the mootness? That certainly is jurisdictional. That has to be addressed first, right? Is the declaration that Chorus has no assets, or the receiver has no assets, is that definitive now?
It can be subject to challenge under the Administrative Procedures Act.
And well, are there deadlines for challenging? This is a year and a half ago that they made their declaration.
I think it would be the normal federal statute of limitations, which is about 6 years. One party, although this has not been below, one party has challenged the determination of worthlessness in California District Court.
Then why do you say that the FDIC's no-value determination renders Miller's claim moot?
Because unless he challenges it in a parallel proceeding.
Well, he says 6 years. He has 4.5 years left to challenge it. He says he's going to challenge it. So why is it moot?
Because even if he challenges it, there's no potential way for getting relief.
Why?
Because basically what the challenge will be was the agency realistic or reasonable, rather, not arbitrary, capricious in finding at the time it made its determination that there was a no value of the assets.
Well, that hasn't been determined yet. So how can you say it's moot? You say someone else is challenging this.
And we were successful in the court affirming the finding that we were not arbitrary and capricious.
But that doesn't bind him, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor.
So why is it moot? He has a claim. Maybe, you can argue it's frivolous, although I don't think you did, but But I don't understand how it can be moot. If he has a potential claim that there are assets here and that he should get a piece of them.
Well, until he challenges...
Hill, but I don't see how it's moot.
Well, until he challenges it, Your Honor, right now there is the determination...
But he's got 4.5 years. And then what's the point of challenging it until he gets over the timeliness issue?
Well, that you're correct, then. The most direct route to dealing with this case is to look at the...
I don't think your mootness argument is good.
Well, the, then the...
So what about the 60-day business? Why should that be jurisdictional? I don't understand that.
Because in Section 1821d13, Congress specifically provided that no court shall have jurisdiction except as provided in this section. And a number of courts have found that this section is 1821d. Now, Section D6A is...
Wait.
Sorry, Your Honor.
What section?
There's an interaction of two sections. One is D6, and one is D13D. And D13D says that, except as provided in this section... And courts agree that this section is 1821D, the whole section. Mm-hmm. No court shall have jurisdiction. The section with the 60 days is in D6, and that's in that 1821D section. So the interaction between the D13D that says no court has jurisdiction except as provided herein links up with the D6 to provide and make it jurisdictional. D6A provides that a court will have jurisdiction if the party files a notice of files a lawsuit within the earlier of 60 days from the date of notice of disallowance or 180 days, whichever is earlier. So the combination of the jurisdictional provision in D6 with the overarching provision that says no court in this will have jurisdiction except as provided in the whole section of 1821D, the linkage of those two indicates a congressional intent that this section would be jurisdictional, and failure to comply with it is a jurisdictional defect. Mm-hmm. Now, the Campbell case on the claims processing does not apply to this particular section. Campbell dealt with another section where the receiver itself set the bar date. Here, Congress is setting the time period for filing the lawsuit. And also in the Campbell case, it was another section again where Congress provided exception if no notice was given by the receiver, or if no notice was received in this particular case. There's no exception here to if there's no notice that was received. So under the plain language of the statute, the provisions that we're looking at, D13D...
Well, it's hardly plain. I mean, you're packing together these two provisions. What difference does it make whether it's jurisdictional or not? Did that alter your position at all?
Well, for practical purposes, because of the equitable... Pardon? For practical purposes, Your Honor, because of the equitable tolling finding by the judge, it doesn't make a jurisdictional, doesn't make a difference, because the FDIC wins under either case, because for equitable tolling, you need extraordinary circumstances where the failure to file was beyond his control and
the
exercise due diligence.
Extraordinary.
Well, I think that the fact that if a post office misdelivers is not an extraordinary circumstance, unfortunately.
As an institutional matter, you don't want to have to deal with equitable tolling defenses in this context. These receiverships are supposed to be wrapped up expeditiously.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, of course, the finding of the jurisdictional is where you don't have to do the fact-finding and things of that nature.
And the statutory text does come pretty close to saying that notice is effective on mailing. I mean, it says
that's
mailing
right.
of notice sufficient.
Is satisfactory. Congress did provide some exceptions for receipt, but in here they basically said...
But, of course, there's an ambiguity in the word mailing. Sometimes it means just initiating the mailing. I mailed a letter. But if, on the other hand, if you said, well, that letter, in that letter I mailed you yesterday, you know, you responded to the letter I mailed you. And in that setting, mailed implies receipt.
Well, in the statutory provision, it says 60 days from the date of any notice of disallowance. And the provision that says that you, under 1821-5A, it says that the agency, when they disallow, must notify the claimant. And they're saying mailing of notice is sufficient to satisfy our obligation to notify the claimant. So even though it's been conflated, the actual language of D6, which is the gives you the starting point, is that 60 days from the earlier of, and one of the components is the date of any notice of disallowance. So it's just putting those two sections together for the mailing. So I think that in our position, it's the date it was issued, unnecessarily mailed.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cunning. So, Mr. Miller, your time had expired, but we'll give you another minute. If note.
Thank you, Judge. The misconstruence of D6A is at the heart of the problem in the district court's opinion. You have to read the language carefully, but it is not jurisdictional. What it says is, in giving you two options to determine when you can file for a judicial review, it says may. It does not say must. It does not say shall. It's permissive, not mandatory.
And it does have to be read in conjunction with the provision in subsection D that controls the court's jurisdiction for judicial review.
Yes, Judge. Subsection D13D that FDIC was referring to a moment ago is an umbrella type of position. It says the courts may not touch what's internal to D, but it doesn't say that every clause, that every subsection within D is jurisdictional in and of itself. And I think this is at the heart of the problem, if I may just complete this comment. You have a clause I and a clause double I. Clause I says that you must file 60 days after 180 days. Clause double I says you must file 60 days after mailing. I said must, but the word is may. And what this really says, what D6A was really intended to do, was to provide a claimant with a spectrum of rights that he had in order to pursue his claim. One of those rights is the right to file for judicial review. A second right is the right to file for administrative review. A third right is the right to continue with a pre-existing action prior to the receivership. In no way does D6A become jurisdictional. The only jurisdictional element within D6 enters in subsection B, where it says that if you don't pursue one of those three alternatives at the end of 60 days after the 180 days in the case of the judicial review alternative, then you lose your right to pursue the claim further. Okay. So in that sense, it's jurisdictional, but only in the B section. And the problem in my case, of course. Thank you, Judge.
Okay.